When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
Hello and welcome to episode 158 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my life's dream and career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. On this episode of the podcast, I am joined by another industry legend. This fella was part of the music business for nearly 50 years, and he takes a break from enjoying his recent retirement to join me on the podcast. Kevin Metcalf is my very special guest, a sound mastering engineer with such an incredible repertoire of all kinds of artists, all types of musical styles on this guy's CV. This fella played such a key role in what we would hear on record, that final mix, that master, that cut to vinyl on hundreds, if not thousands, of singles and album releases over the years. We're talking some of the biggest music stars on the planet: David Bowie, Adele, U2, Queen, ELO, Depeche Mode, The Who, Simply Red, Pulp, Brian Eno, Lee Scratch Perry, Mark Stewart, Adrian Sherwood, and more. And this is one of those episodes where we hear the connections to Paul Weller, because he mastered Illumination, Studio 150, As Is Now, and Catch Flame. But there's also plenty of tales from a career that started in 1973, discussing with cassettes an 8-track at RCA. You're going to love this one. Let's get into it. Another absolute legend, Kevin Metcalf. Thanks for joining me.
Okay, no worries.
Now, we find you enjoying your recent retirement, but my God, what a career you had before that, right?
It was quite a long one, yes, that's for sure, because I started Martian Records in 73 until, 3 years ago I packed in. So, yes, I did my time, really. So, yeah, but very enjoyable career. Met lots of fantastic people, very fascinating, funny, clever, brilliant musicians. Yeah, so yeah, I was lucky.
Most importantly, we should ask how the retirement's going. Are you enjoying, you know, lazing around watching daytime TV? What's life like now?
No, I don't laze around. I'm an active person. After sitting on my bum for 50 years, most of the time, I like to get out and about. I always have. I play golf and I'm a king gardener. I like to go fishing and traveling. So yeah, I'm doing all right. No more sitting in studios. I'm outdoors now, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah. You have a life now.
Rather than smelling vinyl.
Now, look, the artist that you have mastered music for is, I mean, it's incredible, right? And I'm just going to reel off a few of them. David Bowie, Queen, Petula Clark, Simply Red, Orbital, Tom Jones, Underworld, Lee Scratch Perry. Wow. I mean, I could go on and on and on. I want to ask you, is there anyone you wish you'd work with? Anyone you would have liked to have mastered their music by?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I was always a big Bob Dylan fan, and I always wanted to work with Bob Dylan, but unfortunately he never came here to record or mix or master. So that was the one I wouldn't have minded working with. Possibly the Stones too, yeah. I kind of worked with everyone I wanted to work with, really. I felt blessed to be working with the people I was, you know, and I had a long relationship with Queen, of course, and I still speak to the guys this day. So, yeah, I think that's the only one, really. Maybe Bob Marley, but yeah.
Yeah, because you're a big lover of the reggae, and we'll get into that, because a lot of this time period that we talk about you starting out was when, you know, reggae becomes really big in London and in the UK particularly. But so let's talk about the RCA. You mentioned that. So 1973, how old would you have been then?
I was 20. As you can tell, I'm a northerner, and I travelled down with my girlfriend at the time when we were 20 to get the hell out of Teesside because, as I say, it's grim up north. And I had an apprenticeship with ICI as a chemical engineering student. I was doing a specific chemical engineering course, and I had to do a bridging course to go on and do your HND, which I wanted to do. And they wouldn't allow me, they wouldn't spend the money for me to go to college and do it. And said I had to work on aromatics too. I'll never forget it. It was a huge, great oil refinery on North Tees. Yeah, it was pretty terrifying. I could tell you some stories about that, but I don't think we've got all day, and it's not about that. Yeah, people died in that place, you know what I mean? So my cousin lived in Kensington, and I had some friends that lived in Muswell Hill and around that area. And we used to come and visit, and we said, oh, you know, it was so different. You can imagine that. So we first came down in 68. And it was rocking. The place was unbelievable compared to where we lived. And we got to get out of that place and come down. And so we did. We packed it all up in my Ford Cortina Mark II with my record player, my record collection, a couple of cases, and we left. Yeah. And then I was looking for a job. And I was wanting to get into TV, sound, camera work, anything technical to do there because of my background. But obviously, BBC, you're not qualified. You've got to go to university and stuff like that. So I ended up, I used to get the train to Waterloo Station from East Molesey, where I was staying with my cousin for a time. And they used to have, because there was no mobile phones in there, they used to have banks of 20 telephones on the station. And I would get the first edition of the Evening Standard and go looking for flats and jobs. So I'd take a load of change and just go on that phone and apply for jobs. Anyway, I didn't get very far. I got a flat, but I didn't get a job. But then I saw this advert in the Evening Standard, believe it or not, for a trainee discutting engineer. I went, wow, that sounds all right. So I applied for it. I got the job out to 60 people. How I got it, I don't know. But I was keen. I was desperate to get a job and get in the business, you know. So I got the job, and hey-ho. I trained next to the two engineers that were there at the time was Aaron Chatraverty, who was well known for doing Lou Reed. He did Transformer. And Ian Davison, who became a good friend of mine, and we worked at various places together after that. So that was the start of it, yeah.
Wow. And you mentioned coming down in the Cortina with the vinyl. The record, that physical thing, has always been a thing that excites you, it fascinates you, yeah?
Oh, vinyl was the only thing, really, you know what I mean? I mean, when I first moved down, all there was vinyl, cassette, and 8-track cartridge. They were the three formats. Cassette was rubbish. They, you know, everything played at different speeds. Horrible things. 8-track cartridges were great in a car. Sounded brilliant. I loved them. But they would cut off. I think you got 8 minutes, didn't you, or something. Halfway through a track, it just stopped. Then go on to another track and then start again. So, yeah, that was unsatisfactory, wasn't it?
Yeah, I remember having one of those in our car when we were growing up. My mum had that in her little Renault 5, and we had one at home, those big cartridge things, yeah.
There you go. Vinyl was the format in those days, you know. I mean, everyone collected albums, you know. I think you've got to start it from the Beatles, really, for the albums. I mean, everyone was into singles before that. I remember buying lots of singles as a kid. Yeah, well, since the Beatles came out, every album you had to have, you know what I mean? So that was the start of it. And then, you know, the rest is history, isn't it, with The Who, The Stones, you know, The Faces, all those bands, and also the American bands, of course. I was a great lover of West Coast American music as well. They had great engineers over there and great studios. So I did love the sound of West Coast American stuff.
And were you listening to music at that time with a slightly different ear to the rest of us then? You were listening to it from a production, a sound quality type of thing, as much as enjoying the music.
When you start off, you're a fan. Everyone's a fan of the music. And you got it. And there was a group of engineers, I remember, when I was at Delaney, the music centre, which was shortly after I left RCA. And we used to, they were young engineers, assistant engineers, and we'd get records and say, have you heard this? Check this out. This sounds fantastic. Who produced this? Who engineered that? So we were all always looking for great sounding records, yeah.
So talk me through all this world then in terms of mastering the album. Presumably you get handed over something from the record label, from the artist, from the producer that's ready to go. But what is the process? What were you doing day to day?
Well, if you explain it, it's the last stage of recording and the first stage of production. What comes out of the mastering room is what everyone hears. So it's quite a responsible job, really. What happens is that a client will book a session with you, someone who's heard what you've done, and they'll either come along with the artist, the producer, the band, the management, the record label, any of those combinations or more. can turn up in a session. Preferably, I'd just like one or two people. That's it, because there's so many opinions otherwise. And then you would get the tapes. You would have a chat with the engineer and the producer and the artist and say, you know, where did you record it? Were you happy with it? Did you like the mixes? Everything sounding good to you? Do you like it? Are you worried about anything? Okay, let's put it up, have a listen. And then we go through and listen to it. And then I'd put my part in saying, oh, maybe this sounds a little dull. We could brighten the vocals or the guitars up a little bit more. This needs a bit more pump on the bottom end. That kick drum needs to drive. So I would go, let's get some more snap on the snare. So, you know, I'd be doing things like that and then tweaking things and saying, does that sound, would you like that? Does that sound, they'd be going, yeah, yeah, that's good. You're in the right direction. Or no, don't touch it. You know, I mean, we like it as it is. There was no rules, really. My job was really to make a great sounding record, the best I could get it to sound from what I'd got in the first place. Now, obviously, studios, especially those days, and there were so many different studios with different monitoring systems, different acoustics. The variables were incredible, you know what I mean? So, especially, so when you're doing, say, a compilation album, that's the worst. Or the album has been mixed in, say, four different studios by three different engineers, and you've got to piece them together and make it all sound and flow as a piece of art. And so it can be tricky. It can be fairly simple process, you know. Back in the day when we first started at RCA, it was mainly, you didn't really have clients so much. You get the tapes that come in, some from America, some from the UK, and it was basically a try and get it to transfer to disc sounding as good as it did on that quarter-inch tape. And so it was basically a try and transport, being totally, one's an electromagnetic media, and the other one is a physical with a stylus rattling around in a groove. To get the two to sound, that was an art in itself, so yeah.
And how much of it is natural ability, like that, like your ears, versus like what you've learned how to do this thing?
Well, this is it. Once you know the parameters of what you can get on a disc, because there are parameters, you can't do everything that you would like to, whereas you can get away with the CDs. You know, sibilance was always a problem. Phase is always a problem. Low bottom end, rattly bottom end, sub bass. Whoa, when that came around, that's pricked my ears up. So that was, it's knowing what you can do, what you can actually physically get on a disc, you know. And sometimes you'd have to monitor. You would master the album for CD and streaming, of course, these days. And then you would slightly modify that version to get it on disc sometimes. Otherwise, we'd try and cut it exactly the same. What you would do, you'd do either an acetate or a CD ref, and they would take it away, listen to it, all have a chat, come back, maybe do a few little tweaks. And then when that was that, that was it. No one should touch it after that, you know. So that was the way it worked.
Right. Okay. And we'll get into the changes in technology, because obviously this is all tape back in the day, but we move into computers. You mentioned CDs, we get CDs, all that. We'll talk about that as we go through. But I want to touch on the fact you mentioned moving from RCA to the next gig in 75. And when I talk about reggae becoming a big thing, this was driving the change from 7 inches to 12 inches. So again, that becomes something different, and the bass sounds and the dub and all that, it becomes a different world in terms of what you're doing, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. After RCA, I was asked to go to the Music Centre, remember, or Delane Lee. And that was a new studio complex. It had four studios, Telecine facilities, and the largest studio held 135 musicians, which equaled Abbey Road Studio One. And they had mastering rooms as well, of course. So I went there and I worked in Wembley. Now, Wembley, a lot of the Jamaicans had a big base in Easton, Harlesden, Wembley area. So the musicians used to fly in straight from Jamaica with their tapes, their mixers, and want to get dub plates done because there was a big sound clash thing going on. There was house parties, and everyone wanted the newest tunes, the hottest, loudest, most bass tunes that they could get, you know. So I was handy. And so they used to pop in to see me in there, and I hadn't heard, didn't really know a lot of reggae. I knew like Rocksteady and, you know, the early ska stuff, but I didn't really know anything about reggae. But when it first came in, they used to record it on quarter-inch tape, but on the left channel you'd have the vocal, on the right channel you'd have the rhythm. And so to cut a 7-inch single, you would mix the two in mono together for the A side, and then for the B side, you would just double up the left channel with the right channel with the rhythm. So you had a mono instrumental and a vocal with the on the other side. And that was a 7-inch single. Then it started where you get a lot of the producers and engineers. And it was freedom, because when I was at RCA, I wouldn't say it was white coat, but it was kind of pretty strict what you needed to do. And you had to do a transfer process. This, the black guys used to come in, and I had freedom. Kevin, do this, you know, spin the tape back, stick it out, spin this out. And I'm going, really? And we're doing the instrumental B-side. Put the vocal in now. And then I'm going, yeah, and then take it out, you know. So we were doing this all live to disc, you know. God knows what some of them must have sounded like, because we never did a production master afterwards. But it was a lovely freedom that you had, and you felt part of, you know, the creative side more so than just transferring the music from tape to disc. So that was great fun, and people used to like it. And I used to get more and more of the reggae guys coming in. I really got into it, and I met some really good friends. Like Adrian Sherwood is a good friend of mine to this day. You know, I spoke to him just the other day because he's a West Ham fan, isn't he? Chris from Greensleeves, I met Greensleeves Records there, and I worked with them till I retired, really, you know. So I met some great friends. But also, as I was saying, in this studio, it wasn't just that, because you had a rock studio. You had one would do a lot of TV jingles and things like that, the smaller studio. But the main studio, you'd get a full orchestra. And they do a lot of films there. We did a lot of Bond films there, which was fantastic. And I used to go, what it was, you'd have on the ground floor was the echo chambers. Then you had the main studio control room. And then you had telecine. And they used to show on the back of the studio, there was a full-size cinema screen. They used to show the film there. And the orchestra had the back to the film, but we could see them and the orchestra. Well, when you see 130 musicians with, you know, with strings, brass, woodwind, timpani, you know, my hair's standing above the back of my neck now. I'm thinking about it now. I used to go in the projection room and watch this, and this happened. That was something else. And that's gone now. That's part of the car park of Wembley Stadium. They cached it, yeah.
That also sounds so exciting, doesn't it?
I was, 24, something like that, 25. Yeah, loving it, yeah.
Now, you mentioned various different genres there. So is there, from a sound mastering point of view, do you approach those genres of music in different ways, presumably? Are there kind of specific challenges around genres or considerations?
I think you have to, yeah. You know, with the reggae people, they like the bass, don't they? But they also like the hi-hats, you know, as they would say, more chip, Kev. And the high frequencies cause trouble with the cut ahead, and also playing back those higher frequencies. You've got to imagine that modulating at 20,000 cycles per second, and your stylus has got to try and tap that out, because basically the groove follows the sound waves. The bass is a long sweeping curve. The high frequencies are like this, so the groove is going like this, but also at the same time doing this. This stylus has got to be spot on, really. And ideally, playing these back, you would play it back with the cutting stylus that you cut it with. But if you did that, you'd destroy every record. So they use spherical or elliptical stylus, which has got a larger surface area to go in the groove. But it just won't track. If it's not a good cartridge and stylus, will not track the top end. You've heard it. Top end distortion on records. And it really is annoying. So things like that. But also it was temperature control. And I remember in the summer, we didn't have air con in the studio. We had to open all the windows, and the amps were, I think there were only the 50-watt amps back in them days per channel. Any high frequencies, and the guys wanted it loud, it would just overheat and trip out. The amps would trip out to protect the cut ahead, because inside there's tiny coils. And if you damage them, then you're talking bucks to replace it. The cut heads, serious money. So you have to protect the cut head. You cool it down with helium as well, which goes into the cut head, which is inert, so it wouldn't rust the coils. But even so, the temperature would go, and every time I try to cut a track and the hi-hats cut in, it would trip out. So I'd have a client call. I said, well, we'll have to go out. We'll go to the bar for a while, open all the windows, let it cool down, and we'll come back and try again. So, but then we had 300-watt amps before long, and they could handle that power a little better, yeah.
Now, moving on from Wembley, you next go to Utopia Studios. So this is around 1979, 1980. And this is really where you build your reputation as a sound and engineering mastering expert, working with the likes of Roxy Music, Duran Duran, Ultravox, Japan. Tell me about that studio setup.
It was owned by Phil Wainman, who was the drummer out of Procol Michael Harron, and he set up a studio in Primrose Hill, Chalcot Mews. Lovely studio. It was done out in the Westlake style of studios. I don't know if you know of them. It was a company called Eastlake and Westlake. Eastlake was the American company. Westlake is the UK side of it. And they built all their studios pretty much the same, out of stone, bark, velvet curtains. And the idea being that you could take one, because of the monitors, that you could yes, they'd use their own special monitors. The idea being that you had a recording studio with the same acoustic design as the mastering room. So you could take it out of one studio and go in, and theoretically great. Didn't work. Every room is different. You've just got to accept that. And even though you can try and build them exactly the same, they will not stand the same. But they were lovely rooms. And in my studio in Utopia, there was a huge fish tank. And we had marine fish in there. And a fellow from London Zoo used to come over and look after them for us. And it was great. Lovely room. I worked there with Gordon Vickery. Yeah, had a great time. It was like a pop studio. We used to do lots of work in there. Yeah. Wham recorded their first bit in there. Dead or Alive were in. Met Stevie Wonder there, for God's sake, turned up. Heatwave worked there, you know. Can I say Gary Glitter worked there? So, you know, it was great. Absolutely great. Loved it. Was there for 3 years.
Now, we'll get on to the Weller connections in a bit, but I have to ask you, in terms of the Jam, they recorded at the Townhouse at different points, but you arrived at that studio later, I think from 83 onwards, maybe, right? So
82.
Okay, so your paths didn't cross with the Jam, and presumably not the Star Council either.
Well, funny enough, you know, we were talking about Utopia Studios. There was a girl there that worked, who was Phil Wainwright's assistant, called Helen Turner. Name rings a bell, because she went on to play with Star Council.
Yeah, and Helen's been on the podcast, so how lovely.
She was at Utopia. She was Phil Lehman's PA, I think, for some time. She was part of the gang, yeah. And then she, yeah, I think I left before she joined Style Council, but yeah.
And would that have been with the Jam and the Style Council? Were you a fan? Was that your kind of music? Or?
Oh, yeah, because this was the punk era, wasn't it? You know, I mean, when I was from 78, I would say, to 82, was that the punk era? So, yeah, I was involved in that. I worked with some punk bands, yeah. I did some Pistol stuff, actually, some demos with Dave Goodman. I came across Susie Sue, of course, I worked with for years after. Yeah, and a few other punk bands, but I didn't come across. But Paul Simpson, he had about 10 singles. And I think, you know, we were talking about, I worked with Aaron Chetreverdy. I think he may have cut a lot of those singles, you know, because he ended up at another place. What was that called? The Master Room. I think he cut a lot of those singles. Yeah, but a town like Manchester can't like that, you know, going underground. Yeah, I love it. Yeah. I've always liked good, short pop singles and something that has got a bit of aggression as well. That doesn't just, you know, it's not bland. I don't like bland as much. So, yeah, it kicked ass, didn't it?
So, now, look, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was about this relationship between audio mastering specialists and the artist, the producer, the people involved in the making of the music, right? And presumably that it's a collaboration between the two of you, like you're saying, when you're in the studio and you're playing it through together. But let's focus particularly on Paul. So Illumination was the first album that you worked on. How important is that connection between you and an artist as that mastering expert?
I think it helps, put it that way. You know, at the end of the day, the artist wants his record to sound as best it can. You don't have to get on with them as long as it sounds great. Now, it helps if you get on with them, you're on the same wavelength, because otherwise you end up fighting each other, you know, saying, I think it should sound like that. I've never been so arrogant to think I know better than the artist. So, you know, the artist is the one who's made this record in his head to start with. He knows what it sounds like. I'm not going to tell him that it shouldn't sound like. I can suggest we could maybe go a different way on one track or another, but at the end of the day, it's his record, and I'm not going to argue with him about that, because it's his record, it's his life, you know, it's a week's work for me, you know, so that's the way I've always approached it, really. Whatever the artist wants, I mean, if it's totally wrong, well, I'll say it's wrong, but on the whole, it helps to get on with the artist. But I'd never met Paul until he came in, but he was a lovely chap, got on very well with him. I think it helped that I knew the engineer. Was it Stan that did this album?
Yeah, I think he was involved, certainly, yeah.
Well, Stan was a young tape op at Townhouse when I was working there. That's how he started. And then I think he went on to assist in Olympic Studios. And so I knew Stan to start with. Is it Simon Dine? Was he involved in one of those albums?
Yeah, Simon Dine was involved in a bit of Illumination. You're right, yeah.
I think he worked for a record label.
He was at Go Discs at one
point. Go Discs. And he was a client of mine, so he used to come and cut records for Go Discs with me. So, you know, I had a connection there anyway, but I hadn't met Paul until he came in. Yeah, we were going great.
Because prior to that point, his recent albums around that time were Metropolis with Tony Cousins and Tim Young, who I'm guessing, I mean, presumably it's quite an industry where you all know each other. Do you know those guys?
Of course I do. Tony Cousins worked with me at the Townhouse anyway. So there was four engineers of us at the Townhouse when I worked there, and it was Ian Cooper and myself shared one room. Gordon Vickery and Tony Cousins shared the other one. And we used to work a day on, day off. But then Metropolis, one of them, Gary Lang was one of them. Don't know if you know Gary Lang from Queen. He did some early Queen albums and another guy. Anyway, they set up Metropolis and they borrowed shitloads of money and built the studio. And they asked Ian Cooper and Tony Cousins to go along. And Tim worked at CBS. And I know Tim anyway for years, in that lovely lad. They all moved over. I was a bit miffed at the time that they didn't ask me. But it was at the time when there was a crucial... It was the phase between going from analog to digital. And I was very analog. I'm very analog. And the others were more leaning towards the digital side. So we didn't quite agree on that. So if we were to build a room together, there would have been a bit of conflict, I would have thought. So it's probably best we didn't. But yes, I'm still friends with them now. So yeah.
I thought you would be. Okay. So how do you win the business? You know, is it just through those connections with Stan? And because at this point, this is your own setup, right? This is Soundmasters, which you set up in 1997.
That's right. 97, you know, I was saying we worked day on, day off. Well, Ian Cooper and Tony Cousins had left, and we had a couple of other engineers in. And so one week you'd be working Monday, Wednesday, Friday. The following week you'd work in Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. And I used to find out that I was the only one in on a Saturday working all day, you know, and I was struggling to get home for dinner to take my wife out, you know what I mean? And I'm thinking, it's what's going on here, you know what I mean? I worked my butt off, you know, where's everyone else? So I looked at the money that I was pulling in, I'd always fancied doing it, but never had the bottle to do it. And I said, well, enough's enough, I'm going to do it. Because EMI bought Virgin, that's right, as well. And they built us new rooms. I said, fine, I'll give it 2 years. If the rooms work out, I'll stay. I gave them two or 3 years after they built the rooms, and I was doing all right. And I decided to do it on my own. Maybe it's foolish, but...
It works out all right, though, right?
It's totally different because the buck stops with you then. You know, everything's down to you, and you borrow money to buy equipment. You've got commitment to rent. You're employing people. Yeah, it concentrates the mind on the money more so than the music, which spoiled it a bit. Yeah, we did all right until the credit crunch in 2007, after they went pear-shaped.
What was the first job? Can you remember?
The first job I did at my place. I'll never forget it. Have you heard a band called Manson?
Oh, yeah.
Their classic album, their biggest album called Six, was done there. And that was probably the worst job I've ever done in my life.
Oh, no, why?
Well, I was given all the tapes that were done, mastered, and were mixed at a nice studio, probably Metropolis or Townhouse or somewhere. And I spent a day EQing the tracks so that I thought they were okay, sent them off for approval. And then about 3 days or 4 days later, a van arrived, and I've never seen so many cassettes, dats, quarter inches, half inch, you name it. There was a pile of, and what is all this? Took a whole corner of my studio up, and then, who's the guy from Manson? The guy was coming in.
Oh, what was his name? Paul Draper, wasn't it? Yeah.
He had this vision of his head, of his album. It was all in his head. I've got another one like that as well. But and somewhere, all these snippets on the floor, he wanted to insert between the tracks and overlay them and everything. I really didn't want to get into it. 4 days it took to put the album together, day and night. I've got two other engineers to work the night shift. I'd be working day shift. I've got Barry Woodward in from the Townhouse and Simon from Chop 'Em Out to come and work the night. I used to bring sandwiches in for them in the morning. He stayed there as well. It was madness. And I just didn't know anything about the album by the end of it. I was so confused. Lost it. But it was the biggest selling album it's done. It was also a time when the patch player was singing. I had a decision to make to snip the wires. It may not work at all, or we can try and bypass it. Yeah, so that was a session from hell. That was the first one, yeah. I was, oh, no. It's going to be like this.
I was going to get it, say, what a start. You're like, oh my God, what have I done?
Exactly. It was just an nightmare. And especially when you're still building the studio. I shouldn't really have opened. I should have got it all tested out lovely before I did it, but no.
Yeah. So let's talk those Weller connections then. So yeah, Illumination is the first album. I've got it. Here we are. The red sleeve. This was the first one. And yeah, Simon Dyne was connected with Paul at that point. This was September 2002. It came out. His sixth studio solo album. So he's on a roll. You know, we've had Stanley Road. Paul Weller's back on top and all that. And then there are four albums he works on actually. So Studio 150, the next, As Is Now, and then a live album called Catch Flame. So let me ask you a couple of questions around these. Because at the time, the technology is obviously changing. We're starting to step away from tape into a digital world, or we're working with digital tape, DATs, you mentioned. The world that you're used to is changing massively, isn't it?
Well, it done this before then, and also digital formats were, the digital processing wasn't nearly as good as it is probably today. And so, yeah, a lot of it was 16-bit, you know, some of it, the early stuff was 8-bit, you know. I mean, the first digital machines were used, the F1, which was an old Betamax machine that you'd record on. And the CD master was on a U-matic tape, which was basically a recording for video for TV. Anyway, it did get better, but you've got to remember there was a lot of people like myself who were still analog people. And some of them never moved over to digital tapes at all. It moved on to DAT, which was 16-bit as well. So everyone was using DAT. It was a cheap format. You know, multi-track tape costs a fortune, you know what I mean? And so if you're Queen, you can afford to do it, you know what I mean? But other bands can't do that, you know? So computers come around, and once Pro Tools comes around, it's so easy to record it into the box and actually mix it in there. But people learned as time went on that it's not all that it's made out to be, because it is brittle, and when you've got to remember, it is just sampling of numbers. You could almost hear it stepping at times, you know, rather than smooth curves, which is what you get on tape. A lot of people were using it, but a lot of people weren't. But I think what the engineers realised at some stage that you needed to go analog, which was perfect for me, because if it was recorded all in the box, I could wang it out of there through my D2As, and I could record it onto analog tape if I want. Often I would just put it through the amps of the tape machine, just so it'd give you that warmth that it needs. So you've got to use the both, really. And I think everyone realises that now, that, you've got to use a bit, the best of both.
It's interesting you say that, because I was reading Paul's book that he's written with Dylan Jones recently. And it's called Magic. And they were talking about that changeover from tape to Pro Tools for him. And it was the cost of the tape. It was the fact that suddenly they realised, like, he's like, oh, they couldn't get hold of any. And they were like, hold on, it's that much? No, let's move over. But before that, he loves the analogue. He loved the tape. He was kind of, and I think probably Illumination was one of those very first albums for him where he was starting to embrace Pro Tools and the digital, probably through Simon Dyne, I'd have thought.
Exactly, through Simon Dyne. He wanted to do that and use little samples and things like that, which, you know, I wasn't keen on so much. But Studio 150, that was the one done in Holland, was it?
That's right.
And that was done onto tape. That was, as I remember, that was quarter-inch tape, but 30 ips, double speed. So,
well, on that one, we also get that in surround sound. So it's what's called SACD surround and SACD stereo 5.1. They never did that again on any of Weller's albums, but that's a whole different approach, right?
Did I do those?
Yeah. So that's Studio 150.
No, because in those days, Underworld, talked me in to doing surround sound. Well, I wish I'd never started, because I really, it was one of these where you really need a setup, a separate studio, all set up. Whereas I was cutting vinyl in my studio and trying to do surround work at the same time. So I had a temporary system. I did it on NS10s, Yamaha NS10s. What did I have? I had a 5.1 amplifier, which was a nice one, and an NS10 subwoofer. And we used to play some surround the room. But what it meant was you had six channels to play back, which you'd listen to. Then you had six channels to go back into record. And then you had six more channels coming out to monitor what you were recording. Well, the patchwork involved with analog to digital, going through A to D converters, because I did it in analog.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I did my surround sound in analog because I had two of everything, you know, so nightmare.
I also wonder if for us, the buying public, you were having to then play that on your like your home cinema system to get any value from that whatsoever, right?
Yes, yes. Well, there was an SACD player you could buy, you know, but you needed I think that uses the amplifier in that, and, you know, a 5.1 system, yeah.
I've not got that copy, I have to say. So if any fans are listening and that's their preferred version of it and they can tell me why that added anything to the experience, I'd love to know. But I'm guessing also Paul's team, they probably weren't recording in the way to... That's probably an afterthought, I'd have thought, right? So they probably weren't recording in up front with that in mind.
Yes. It usually is, you know, we've done the album. Oh, there's a new format out. Let's do surround. Okay. Let's go to the mix room and do it. I mean, when I first heard it, I mean, what did I hear? That they were doing a demo at the townhouse and it was Can't Buy a Thrill. Steely Dan. Great band. Great sounding records. Well, they put it on in this room and I was thinking, oh, this sounds lovely. It's going to be great, this. I love it. And here it comes in, all the guitar intros and lovely drums in hand, and the singing starts. And all of a sudden, the backing vocals come out the back. Where did they come from?
They're behind me, right.
Stop it, you can't do that. So, you know, it was getting used to what you could do and what you couldn't do. The best one I heard was No Vocals, Orbital. I did a live album about 5.1. I was really pleased with that. That sounded great because they used the surround rather than just... A lot of them are live albums with just the ambience, the crowd in the back and a bit of ambience. To get a chance to listen to that Orbital one, it's great.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I love Orbital. I'll just check that out. So then we get As Is Now, which bits of that were also recorded in Holland. When you'd be mastering, would Paul come into the studio and sit there with you?
Yeah, he'd pop in. He only lived not far away, I don't think. I was in Latimer Road, which is basically Notting Hill, and I think he was down the road. In fact, I think I got a lot of my jobs like that because I was handy.
He wasn't the best, but he was close. Nice to everybody.
Brian Eno used to come in. He lived down the road. Damon Albarn's studio was around the corner, you know, so they all used to pop in. So it was great. That was handy.
And Paul has always been somebody who's very hands-on with his own production. He doesn't kind of send stuff away to other people, right?
He's a man who knows what he wants, isn't he? You know, he knows what he wants out of a record, you know. So, yeah, he writes them all, doesn't he? He's got a vision of what it should be. He does let people like Simon Dine get involved in them, you know, and that, and put their brushstrokes on it. You know, when I remember growing up, a lot of artists used to play with each other, you know, and help each other out on records, you know, and that, and I quite like that. And I think Paul's done that in a few cases with Noel Gallagher and a few other artists that he can collaborations. And I think, yeah, fair dues. Why not?
So the final album that you mastered was Catch Flame. So this was Paul Weller's live album. This was recorded at Alexander Palace, December 2005. This was released on the V2 record label.
Don't remember it.
Well, it was the final gig that features Steve White on drums and Damon Minchella on bass with Weller's band. But how would you approach mastering a live album? Is that a different kettle of fish entirely again?
It's down to the quality of the mix on them, really. I've heard some atrocious live albums. Very few good live albums really going. If you just get a monitor feed off the PA, then it's rubbish, you know what I mean? So you need a proper recording facility there, you know, with it all. You know, the mobile studios were pretty big in those days, or earlier than that. My favourite live album was Lou Reed's Rock and Roll Animal. Check that out. There's a version of White Light, White Heat on there, and Heroin. Sweet Jane's on it as well. No, I digress, sorry.
And I love this.
Do I approach it differently? Yes, really. I try and use as little of the applause as possible because it's so irritating. It's fine the first time, but when you listen to it again, it's just so irritating. So I try to keep that short and sweet and low in level because you don't need that. It depends on the quality of it. You get a lot of feedback and stuff, you know, mistakes. In the end, live albums didn't become live albums because a lot of stuff was overdubbed, you know, out of tune vocals redone, you know, which is cheating, isn't it, really? So the sound,
yeah, it is a bit. Well, quite a lot, yeah.
Good live album. It shows you the quality of the bands. really, if they can knock it out live.
I need to ask you about your nicknames, right? So on quite a lot of these recordings, obviously the great thing is you get credited.
In the early days, we didn't get credited much.
So there is Careful Kevin.
Yes, yes. I was always careful, yes.
So this was Susie Sue. I think Deep Purple had you down as Careful Kevin as well.
I have no say in what they put on the record. Don't call me, hey, I'm going to put this on the record. They just do it, don't they, you know? Kevin Overpar Metcalf.
That was on New Sound. That was the Paperback Volume 1, yeah. Kevin Overpar Metcalf. Was that based on the golf?
Yeah.
We had Herbstalk Kevin as well.
Yeah, that was when there was a lot of weed flying around. Back in the reggae days.
Okay. Yeah. We had Kevin Batears Metcalf.
Who put that?
That was Mr. Scruff, the Friendly Bacteria album.
Some lovely fella. I miss Mr. Scruff. He was great. It's a great album. He did a press release and drew me. I've got it framed somewhere. It's really funny. It's got the fella out of someone on telly. It's very funny.
I wanted to mention On You Sound because I'm such a fan of that record label and of Adrian Sherwood and the Dub Syndicate, Gary Clare, or African Edge, all those things, the pop group. I know you work with Mark Stewart, who we must talk about because sadly passed away recently. I'd love to see Weller work with Adrian Sherwood. I think he's such a... But like an absolute genius in the production space, isn't he?
Yes. He's got his own little niche he's found in the reggae world, which is respected on both sides, really, now. And especially now that he's been doing it for so long. He's nearly as old as me. He won't thank me for saying that, but he's getting on. His input to the music business has been phenomenal. His catalogue. You know, he's crossed over with bands, hasn't he? And he's never quit. He's never done anything cheesy. I wish he could have done, you know. I mean, the news things was his Barmy Army football songs, I suppose. But good lad, Adrian, yeah. Don't tell him I said that, but he's, yeah. Well,
yeah, and I think even like the recent work with, obviously, Lee Scratch Perry, those final couple of albums were incredible.
That was one of the last albums I did. In fact, the day I retired, the dub album for, what was it called?
Yeah, it was, Heavy Rain was the dub album. Rainford was the original.
The dub album of Rainford went to number one in the Billboard reggae charts the day I retired, and I mastered that. So that's a nice way to go, wasn't it?
Oh, incredible. Loved all that stuff. Really, I'm a really big On You Sound fan, like I say. And if I can find a connection between Adrian Sherwood and Mr. Weller, I'd love to have him on.
I would work with Adrian. What kind of music do you think he would do with it?
I don't know. It'd be nice to see them just to deconstruct some stuff, or even a remix I'd be happy with, you know.
Yeah, well, he's done some great remixes, Adrian, over the time, yeah.
So let me ask you about Mark Stewart. So the pop group was something that you worked with. You worked with Mark and you mastered his Politics of Envy album, for instance, in 2015. This was an another absolute legend in the music industry who sadly passed away in the past couple of months.
Another one gone. I first met him, I worked with him on, is it the Y album that's got Jerusalem on? I got that album originally.
That would have been really early doors, like early 80s, yeah? Late 70s, early 80s. So what did you make of him back then?
He was a nutter, absolute nutcase. He was, and Adrian used to sit at the back of the studio just smiling while he's giving me grief. He said, we were doing that album, he'd say, can I have a bit more top on it? Yeah, we'd bright it up a bit. It's a bit bright already. Oh, right. I think we should have more bass on this track now. Yeah, I said, all right, we'll put some bass on. Well, I can't hear the mid so much now. Matt, just stop. Stop here. We take all that out and we just turn it up. All right? That's the same thing. Could he get his head around it? No. He couldn't get his head around that. So we spent hours on that album. It was an absolute nightmare. But the album was fucking, you know, wow, what is this? You know what I mean? What is this? I did a few of his albums anyway. Roll the clock forward to 2015 or something. We remastered that album that I did originally.
I love the fact you've been in the industry so long, you're remastering all your own stuff.
I've done that a few times, remastered.
Brilliant.
Yeah. We remastered it, come to my house. I'm in my studio in my home now, you see. I built my studio at home, when was that? 2014. He comes to my house and his manager, and he gets on with Bart. He's the only person that has ever tickled me when I'm mastering. Stop it. And he talks. Now, he was clean as this time, you know, not back in the early 80s. He was clean, but still mad as a hatter, mad as a box of frogs. but nice with it this time, you know what I mean?
When you're looking at remastering, is it the technology that helps you do that, the advance in technology that helps you do that now?
I'll tell you what happened with this, because that's quite fresh in my mind, this album. I'd just done a new album that he put out, which was good, and then he wanted to remaster this album. His manager called me and said, I want to remaster this wire. I said, I did that originally, didn't I? And she said, yeah. Oh, okay. Well, Mark's compiled it onto Pro Tools from tape. He's really liked the sound of it, and he wants you to cut it. I said, well, look, can you ask him to bring the original tapes with him? Because I don't know what he's done to get to that process. So he came up. He gave me this CD that had burnt off a computer, put it in, played it. I went, no, 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 what have you done? Tried to get him to tell me the process he'd gone through to do it. I said, okay, let's put that quarter-inch tape on from back there. And we A-B'd him. I matched the level. Well, it was chalk and cheese. He said, well, I spent ages compiling all this, and I've been with an engineer, and so it's up to you. You want to put out a load of shit, or do you want to go with this? You know, and he had to admit that it was a load of shit compared to that. So we put it out. We mastered it. Everything sounds great. And I'm still pissed off with him for this, even though he's died on me. It was sent, I didn't cut the vinyl, it was sent to Abbey Road Studios, to Miles. Latest thing is half-speed cutting. They do it at half speed, so it's slower, and so it can accommodate those high frequencies a lot better. It's supposed to be a lot cleaner. Now, there's a guy in Abbey Road called Miles Sherrill, who's a great mastering engineer. I'm not knocking him. He's a good engineer. And he does that. He specializes in the half speed cutting. Which, fine. Okay, you want to do that? That's popular. Right. The album starts getting promoted for the because of the release. Big marketing spread on it. Why, the new album by the pop group, and it's been cut, Abbey Road, RSP by Marshall. I get the artwork, they send me a copy over. My name isn't anywhere to be seen on that. I phone them up and give him a bollocking. I said, we live on our credits. And I was retiring, so it didn't matter to me. But young engineers rely on their credits. That's how you get your work in this business. So it may be silly, really, because it could be down to the engineer or the producer of the studio they've been in. Just because it gets in the top 10 or something like that, people are fickle and say, oh, we'll go with him. So I was annoyed. I was annoyed that they didn't give me a credit on it. But I'm very sad that he's died, because I really liked him.
Let me ask you about a couple of people who've been on the podcast before we wrap up. Friends of the podcast who are lovely. So Nick Hayward.
Sorry about Nick Hayward.
Well, is this the Pete Burns story?
Yes.
So this is Pete Burns from Dead or Alive. And Nick Hayward, tell me about this.
Dead or Alive, it wasn't just Pete Burns, it was Dead or Alive, Scallies, Naughty Boys. They were doing a recording in Utopia Studios, one of the studios there. I was mastering Nick Hayward stuff. I had a connection with Air Studios, and I did a Paul McCartney album. And I ended up working with Geoff Henry, the Beatles engineer, you know, great. And he was lovely. He took on Nick Hayward's solo projects, and he did a couple of singles with him, and he'd come down, and then they'd finished the album. Nick Hayward was in with me mastering his album. Everything's going well until lunchtime. And then he said, oh, I'm just popping out to go to the loo. I'm kind of jogging along. I've got pretty much side one sorted as we want it. And he disappears, and I'm waiting. I've got a couple of other tracks and a couple of questions to ask him on while he's gone. Well, he's gone half an hour. So he came back in about 40 minutes, and he was white as a sheet. Opened the door. I said, I want to speak to the studio manager. I said, well, there's the chief maintenance engineer. You could talk to him. So I went out and talked to him and never came back. That was it. And then I found out what them Naughty Boys had done. He went to the Kazi, didn't he? And there was a gap underneath and over the top. And they took all the fire extinguishers out and blasted him underneath and over the top.
This was all linked to, was it Melody Maker or NME? He'd been reviewing for them.
And slagged off the last Dead or Alive single. So they but it totally ruined my session. It went dead. I didn't know what to do. Here I am on my own. Who do I phone?
Oh, <my God. laughs> Wonderful.
Nick Hayward, he was a gentle fella as well, you know, gentle, quiet, you know, choir boy looking like almost. Yeah, dreadlocks, scallies, they were naughty. They were good lads. They were funny, but yeah, you wouldn't want that on anyone, really.
Oh my goodness, man, how funny. So a couple of other connections who have been on the podcast because they've worked with Paul. Catherine Williams, the album Leave to Remain was one that you mastered as well.
But that was a nice album, wasn't it? Soon to remember. Catherine Williams, yeah. I didn't know that was she connected to Paul?
Well, only recently they've just done some stuff together. It hasn't yet been released.
Oh, right, okay.
And then Rod Argent and Colin Blunstone, Zombies.
I was a huge fan of the Zombies. Ever heard the album The Rock Machine Turns You On?
No, I haven't.
Check it out. It's from the 60s, really, and it's got Spirit on. It's got the Zombies on it. Oh, it's a great album. It's great. There's some classic tracks on it. And Time of the Seasons on there, which is
such a great tune, isn't it? Great tune. One of Paul Weller's favourite tunes ever, by the way.
Really? And I was always in love with that track. So I got to work with a guy called Steve Orchard, who's an air engineer, who I worked with on lots of different projects. And he is the brother-in-law of Rod Argent. He was doing some engineering for him, and we did an album together, and they really liked it. And then they wanted it remastered, so we did that. And Rod was very, very, very nice people. Yeah, I enjoyed working with them, and Colin was lovely too. But they're getting on now, aren't they? God, I'm getting on, but they're all...
We're all getting on, my friend. We're all getting on. Let me ask you about Queen. We must, before you go. I mean, you work with Queen so closely.
Yeah.
And I mean, what a band. What a loss Freddie is and was. And I mean, the fact that that album on vinyl is still in like the top 10 vinyl charts is the greatest hits, volume one, is remarkable, isn't it?
I was reading in the paper today. There's some musical going on at the moment. There was Brian and Roger in the middle. The picture of them. And there's a musical. Something's opened up again. They were the days. Great days, Queen. You know what I mean?
It was quite fractious, though, the relationship. So it's particularly between Roger and Brian, wasn't it? Roger always wanted like the snare louder, and Brian wanted the guitars louder, right?
I never saw any real animosity, but there was always this bit, oh, snare sounds a bit loud, doesn't it? I can't quite hear my guitar.
Can you put my bit louder in the mix, thanks.
Don't sound a bit loud on this bit, Kev, don't you? Little time to be diplomatic to everything and just agreeing with everyone.
How hands-on was Freddie with the production then?
I think he was full on with the production. I was never in the recording studio with him or the mixing room with him, so I don't know. He left it to me and to Brian and Roger that would come in. So he would just phone up, I'd get to listen to it and say, what do you think, Freddie? And he'd say, oh, it sounds lovely, darling, you know what I mean? And that was it, you know what I mean? No, he didn't, because I did Barcelona with him as well, which with...
Montserrat Caballé. That came on the radio the other day. Maybe my missus was like, I haven't heard this so long. This is such a great song.
That was a real test to cut that because it's over 4 minutes long and there's some quiet bits and there's some really loud bits and trying to get that so it doesn't stop. Yeah, I was really pleased with the end of it. It was hard work though. Yeah.
When you're looking back, is there a moment or an album or a 7-inch or 12-inch that you go, I'm so proud of? That's the one for me.
I love Japan Records, Tin Drum, a guy called Steve Knight, fantastic engineer. I was very pleased with that. Dear Prudence by Susie and the Banshee, I was pleased by that. Quite a few I've been pleased. Some I haven't, like, we go to Queen, if you like, and we go to Made in Heaven after Freddie died. That was a very emotional album to master. That was probably the hardest one to do. Dave Richard, who produced and engineered this, who worked in Switzerland, but had just come off working with David Bowie in America for about a year. And he came back and he wasn't in the best of health. And on that album, we had a thing called a Dolby Sonic Processor. And it was fine to bring certain things to life, but I had one in the studio and Dave liked it. And we ended up putting it on every track. And every time I hear the album, that original album, I'm sure Bob Ludwig's done it again without it. Every time I heard that, even in a pub or somewhere, I could hear this tits on the top of it singing, Dave, it didn't need it. It didn't need it. Poor old Dave's dead now as well, you know. I mean, everyone's going, man, and it's really upsetting. A lot of people we've lost.
Yeah, of course, man. It must be nice to see the vinyl coming back. I mean, it's definitely making a resurgence. Because for you, is that the ultimate format in terms of sound? In terms of the quality of sound, is it vinyl?
Yeah. Not just that. I like the idea of side one and side two. I like five tracks. I think you've got a limited listening span. And to listen to 30 minutes to 60 minutes of music in one go. It's too much. Too much. I like five types of salad. Lovely. 20 minutes, anything under 20 minutes aside the album, turn it over. Maybe not play it all. I like the physical fact of placing it on the turntable. I like to check the strobe to make sure it's going the right speed. It's everything about it. I like the sleeve. I like the artwork. I like the, I can read the credits. Yeah, I can read the lyrics. So, yes, to me, it's the best format, without a doubt, yeah. And the others are convenient, yes. And they serve a purpose. But, you know, I'm glad I'm not living in this day and age where I'm listening to my music on my bloody iPhone. I'm glad I don't do that. I'll never do that. My son's a drummer in a band, you know. A good band as well, called The Hunter. Check them out. I hear them saying, listen to this, to the band. Listen to this new tour band, this. Listen to that. Well, how can you tell anything from that? Tell me. Stop doing that. Yeah.
And somebody coming into the industry in your area, so audio masterings, what advice would you give them coming in?
It's difficult getting in, isn't it? You know, I mean, I've trained a few lads over my time and they've all done well and most of them are still in the game. But it's getting in is the hard bit. You know, I was lucky, wasn't I? You know, getting out of 60 people out of an advert in the Standard. You see, when I was employing assistants as well, I didn't want... a lot of people would go to the London School of Audio, you know, they've got a good idea of what goes on, but they've also got a preconceived idea. So anyone coming in, I'd say, forget all what you've learned there. Forget that. Now we start from scratch and this is how we do it. And that was hard. So I'd sooner have someone who was just an audiophile, but was keen as mustard. That's what you want. Who wanted to work, who wanted to learn, who wanted to stay, didn't want to go home at lunchtime, you know, or go home at 6 o'clock. You wanted people who wanted to work and get on, ambitious, have a pleasant nature as well. You know, you've got to be able to get on with clients. You've got to get on with everyone. So, you know, you've got to be sociable. Yeah, so I would advise people just don't give up. Knock on doors, keep knocking. What else can you do? You know what I mean? But I don't think you've got to be qualified. It's not qualifications, really. You can throw them out the window. Yes, it helps if you're intelligent. All the young people are computer literate, aren't they? Whereas I wasn't. I had to learn from scratch. You know, they'll be all right. Just got to keep trying. Keep trying. And if not, do your own thing. Find a local band. Record them, you know. Buy a few bits of kit. Get that way.
Kevin, this has been honestly such a joy to spend time in your company. I've got two final questions for you before you go, okay? They're Paul Weller related. So you are allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, or Solo. What would you go with?
Ooh, I think I'd go to the early stuff like Underground, Going Underground. I like the punky stuff, really. I wasn't keen on The Style Council. I wasn't keen. I don't know why I wasn't keen. But then I liked his solo stuff. I thought that he writes some lovely songs, doesn't he? Yeah, I think I'd stick with his early stuff for me.
And then final question. So the purpose of this podcast is to chat to people who have got connections with Mr. Weller, whether they're big connections, they're people who are in his bands and all that, or there are people who have had fleeting passing moments, which is just lovely to hear about, and hear about your careers and all that as well. But the purpose of the podcast, Kevin, the reason I created the podcast was to get an interview with Paul Weller by the end of it. I used to be a radio presenter. Not interviewing Weller was my one big regret from giving up my radio career.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So if it happens, what should I ask him? What would you like to know, Kev?
What do I want to know, Paul Weller? What's he doing now? What is he doing now? Anyway,
he's making a triple album, I think.
A triple album? You should keep them down to 20 minutes aside, done.
Is that the thing? 20 minutes aside, bosh.
Yeah, done. Next album. Triple album. What is it? Old stuff, new stuff, demos?
New stuff. So constantly moving forward, constantly what's the next thing. You know, he's had two number one albums in the past few years of new material, still going.
You know, I haven't listened to music since I've retired.
And any? Or just new stuff, do you mean?
I've listened to my son's band and I've listened to some old stuff. But no, I haven't listened to new stuff. I've given my ears a total rest. Can you imagine walking into a studio at 10 o'clock in the morning and sometimes leaving at 2 o'clock in the next morning and all you've done is listen to music all day? Your head would come home. You'd always take a tune with you as well when you came home.
Yeah, those earworms, yeah.
Kind of crazy. So to me, I've got 3 years. I'm not listening to music. You know, obviously, I listen a bit and I'm still interested in it. But no, don't miss it. I don't miss listening to music 24/7. I like to hear the stream, the birds. I like natural sounds. So yeah. So, yeah. But listen, there's loads more, you know.
There must be a book in this career. Is that something that would interest you?
Oh, I have a title for it as well.
Go on.
A book, yeah. It's Tales from the Cutting Room Floor. some stories, yeah. My mates, though, from yesterday, to come and talk with us.
If and when that ever happens, man, oh, we would all love to read that. This has been such a joy. Thank you, Kev.
I hope you get your interview with Paul. So I'd like to know why he hasn't had an interview with you. Ask him that.
I'll send it on. Thank you so much for your time, man. Really appreciate it.
Okay. You're welcome. Bye-bye. Take care.
My thanks once again to Kevin Metcalf for joining me on the podcast. More details in the show notes, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. We'll keep updating the page as well. I'll do a little playlist. We'll have some photos for you as well. So do check it out on the website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. And whilst you're on the website, why not head into my store for all your official podcast merchandise? And if you fancy it, you can get a virtual coffee as well. Just for £3, you get a shout out on the podcast. Hello to Georgia Moroso. Thank you to you for your continued support. Hello to Russ Ratton, says, loved every single episode. Amazing work with amazing guests. Keep up the good work, mate. Hey, Russ, much appreciated, my friend. Hello to Darren Barker, who says, you've done an amazing thing and created an unforgettable legacy, Dan. Just brilliant, really. Hey, Darren, that's really kind. Thank you. Hello to Foz. Thanks to you for your virtual coffee. Hello, Grant. Hi, Duncan. Thanks for your support. Hello to Ian. Thank you to you too, sir. Alex McLaughlin, who says, great chat with Chris Free. I once bought an A-Craze CD from him on eBay. It wasn't until it arrived with a little personalized note that the penny drops as to who the seller was. Lovely bloke. Hello, Sean Wilson. Thank you to you for your continued support, my friend. Hello, Rich Gill. Thanks to you for your virtual coffee. John Reed and Peter E. Much appreciated. If you want to get involved, just head to my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. You can also get in touch. Social media. It's at WellerFanPod on Twitter or X or whatever the heck that thing's called right now. Or on Facebook, Instagram and Threads. You can find me by searching for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. Do spread the word. Make sure you share with your Paul Weller loving friends, the Jam, the Style Council, Weller Solo. All welcome here. Do continue to spread the word. It's really appreciated. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.